You are listening to The Cumberland Road, and I'm your host, TJ Melanowski. The following is a faith conversation with Reverend Danny Willis, a Cumberland Presbyterian minister in Owensboro, Kentucky. Danny has a provocative journey, a journey of overcoming addiction, broken relationship, and multiple health issues that almost caused his death. Instead of losing faith, Danny found a deep and profound faith in Jesus Christ that has led him into ministry. I met with Danny in a transitional period in his life, as he just finished a pastorate and is discovering what is next in his journey. His wife, Jessica, joined in on our conversation. Married for 9 years, their journeys intertwine in a beautiful way. Here is a faith journey of Danny Willis. Danny, we met a few years ago, and I got bits and pieces of your faith journey. And it's a treat to be able to kind of swing back around and get the whole story and your whole journey. But I remember you telling me vaguely that you had a medical scare, and I don't remember what it was, but we can start there in our conversation or start in another place if you wanted to lead up to that.
No, that'd be fine. We could start there. Try to make it as short as possible.
No, take your time. You've got my attention. So
my whole life, I weighed about 330 pounds. And then about the last 4 or 5 years, I ballooned up to 580 pounds is what I weighed when I went into the hospital.
And for those who are listening, just for perspective, you're probably a quarter of that now.
Yeah, I'm 6'4" and I'm 200 pounds.
Okay. All right.
So yeah, I was 580 pounds, and I was an alcoholic as well. And my whole life, you know, I stayed away from God a lot. So there's a lot of things I've done in my life I shouldn't have done. But I was diagnosed with it being fatty liver because of my weight, but alcoholism also, you know. But
how early did you get into alcohol?
Oh.
Early 20s.
Yeah, I started a lot more probably in my about 20 years old. But from 18 on, I was drinking. But most of the time I drank too much beer. But that's why I got so big. But I was diagnosed that NASH, non-alcoholic liver cirrhosis. And I bounced around a few hospitals here. And I just couldn't be put on the transplant list because of my weight. And then I wound up at Mayo Clinic in Rochester, Minnesota at the end. And they told me if I would sign to get a stomach sleeve surgery, that they would put me on the transplant list. Mm-hmm. So I think I lived there to total of maybe 4 months in a transplant center. It was where they had a lot of people there that were hospice and major illnesses. We just all lived in a house together there. But I don't really remember the last time when I went in. But when I went in for the long haul there at the end, I was just losing my mind all along the way. But by the time I went in for the long haul, I was in the hospital for a year. Mm. I was in and out of a coma, and it was rough. But the thing is once they called my family and said they were going to unplug me in 2 hours away. So I was past the point of being able to get a transplant.
Well, let me interrupt you for a minute. Let's go back a little bit. So you're in a home and you're on a waiting list. And so
I was on a waiting list for transplant.
So you need to be in that house on a waiting list for a quick turnover. Is that correct?
Yeah. You had to be close to the hospital. Yeah.
Okay. Could you hold a job at that time? Or chained to, well, maybe metaphorically?
Yeah, I was chained to the hospital.
Okay.
But I was beyond being able to work. When I realized there was something wrong with me, I was at work taking something off a shelf and just fell face first into the shelf. Mm. And everybody around me could tell I wasn't feeling good anymore. So they told me I couldn't come back until I figured out what was wrong, and I never came back. I was diagnosed with stage 4 liver cirrhosis.
How old were you?
I was 37 years old. They told me I had 6 months to live. Fast forward again back to where I went into the hospital for the long term. I was there for a year.
So and how come you were in the hospital for 12 months?
Because of everything that happened. I was there, you know, like in a coma state for a while, just waiting for the transplant.
It's waiting. You have to have a certain donor to be able to get the liver. And so he had to wait for somebody who had... he was 500 pounds and 6'4".
He had to have
somebody that had that, you know, a liver that would be able to suffice with the body habitus that he had. So,
and blood type.
Okay. So they had to wait. And on top of that, he was told he had to lose so much weight before his surgeries as well. So while he's already feeling horrible with this liver problem, he's also having to eat apples. All day long.
I drank water
trying to get down to a certain weight.
Yeah.
And he didn't really make it because, like he said, after when he was to that point, he had 2 hours. And they were telling his wife at the time that they needed to come in. He was blessed with a liver.
Yeah. Wow. They called 30 minutes after they called him and said, we're going to plug him in 2 hours. They found the liver that matched me. And fortunately, there was no one else on the list nowhere that was the right candidate. So they've said, we're going to try.
So while you're waiting, your health is declining, which led you going from living in a home, kind of in a waiting period, to where you actually needed medical care around the clock.
Yeah, basically in hospice.
Okay. And how old are you at this time?
37.
So you're a young man.
Yeah. And I turned 38 in the hospital. So, but yeah, when they did get that liver in and they said they'd go ahead and give me a shot, they done it and wasn't nothing turning around for me 3 or 4 days later. They didn't understand what was going on. So they done tests or whatever. And they found out that I had a mucormycosis, which is basically fungus growing in your body. I guess I got that close to, you know, being gone. And they didn't even want to operate on me because if you get mucormycosis, period, you've got like 30% chance to live. And then if it spreads throughout your body, nobody had ever lived from it. And it was in multiple parts of my body. But they finally talked to me and said, he'd been through so much and he's got the liver was a great match. And they said, he's done through so much, give it a shot, you know. So they did it. And I wound up losing three quarters of my right kidney, half of my right lung, a big portion of the top of my right shoulder, a big chunk out of the top of my left thigh. Is that all of it?
I think so.
Yeah. And this is right after liver transplant and stomach sleeve surgery. So
they went back in, had to open him up like an autopsy.
And
take all this out.
And I'm the first person that has ever lived from it.
Yeah, you're a walking miracle.
Yeah, I guess. Yeah. God gave me a chance, man. That's why I'm here today. Amen.
Where is your headspace? I mean, you have a lot of time to reflect and to think as you're feeling sick, as your health is declining. I imagine that you could go into some pretty dark places.
But I never did.
What was your experience? Yeah, go ahead.
I did have like hallucinations and dreams or whatever. They were so vivid that sometimes I got to try to realize were they fake or were they real, you know. But before, I was great. I mean, I felt great. I was always in a good mood. I was convinced that I would not die. I knew in my head God was not going to let me die, and I'm not gonna. And the only person that believed me was my son, which is now 21 years old, but he's the only one who believed it because of the circumstances. But he gave me a miracle. No doubt.
Well, let's talk about your faith, Danny. As a child, what was an early experience with God? Did you grow up in the church? Did you have an encounter outside of kind of the traditional parameters of faith?
Definitely. I didn't grow up in what you would consider a Christian home. We didn't go to church and we didn't read the Bible, pray openly or anything like that. But I had a brother that had Down syndrome. I mentioned to you earlier. Mm-hmm. And he took a lot of my parents' time. So I spent a lot of the weekends and summers and just whenever I could, I was with my great grandparents. And they would take me to a Methodist church in Island, Kentucky. And I was baptized there probably 8, 9 years old. I don't even remember, but by the time I got 16 years old and got a job and started driving, I didn't go and spend as much time with Mama and Papa as what I used to. And I just went away from the church altogether, basically. And I guess nobody had ever really told me they were proud of me in my life. And as soon as I got out of school, I got a good job at a local plant. And within 4 years, I was a supervisor of the plant. Mm. You know, I patted myself on my own back and I'm like, nothing's going to hold me down. I can do everything I want to do on my own. I don't need nobody. And that included God in my mind, you know. So that's the way I lived my life for a lot of years. That's what led to the alcoholism and the drug use and all of that was just, I was trying to fill a hole in my life where God should have been, you know. Mm. It's temporary joy you can find at the end of a bottle, but it'll kill you. And you're not going to find true joy there, not lasting joy, you know.
And this is in retrospect. So during that time, though, were you able to articulate, hey, this is why I'm drinking, this is why I'm experimenting with drugs?
Oh, never. I was just living my life and having fun. Yeah. No, I never thought of that, you know.
You were doing what Danny wanted to do. You had cash exactly. In your pocket and a good career. Yeah. And
what I always had good jobs, you know. Mm-hmm. And, you know, I lost one of my good jobs because I was too good to the people there. You know, I tried to resolve issues instead of firing people, and it got me in trouble more than once to the point I lost a job over that. They even told me, we didn't hire you to be a minister. We hired you to be a supervisor.
Oh, wow. So let's go a little deeper in this. You really weren't faith connected, and yet here you have employers saying we didn't hire you to be a minister.
I've always had a helpful heart. Mm-hmm. Like I think a God put something in me, but I didn't know where it came from, you know. Mm-hmm. I would counsel people. And yeah, I would never pray with people and such, but I always wanted to try to help people with their problems, you know. I always had that mindset. And I find a lot of it was because some of the stuff I had been through. And I was like, I don't want nobody to wind up there, you know. Mm-hmm. I had a very rough first marriage, you know. We were both alcoholics and such and did all this stuff. And she was more with other drugs. And she just wouldn't give it up. After I got out of the hospital, I found out she'd done found boyfriends while I was in the hospital sick. She thought I was convinced I was going to die, I guess. And then I came home and I tried to, you know, repair things, but she continued with that type of behavior until the point she just told me to go on. She found another guy. So that was a long, rough marriage.
So. Yeah. Drugs, alcohol, and maintaining relationships. That's a real hard thing to do for anyone.
Yeah. And I was gone for work most of the time. The jobs I had were good jobs, but I literally worked 80, 90 hours a week sometimes.
Mm. Mm. You were pushing that body pretty hard, Danny.
Oh, I was. Yeah. I tell people I went from February the 12th, my birthday, until Christmas 1 year without a day off. So, yeah, work was my God kind of then, I guess.
In your journey, where did you find yourself reconnecting with your faith? So you'd go to your great grandparents and you attended worship, but when were you reconnected with your faith? When did God re-enter the picture?
My son, which is another hole. He got some kind of disease. He never really got diagnosed properly, but he was in and out of a children's hospital for 3 years straight. Mm. We thought we was going to lose him and everything.
Is this after your...
Yeah, I got sick.
Before, okay.
Right before, yeah. Yeah, we didn't know if he's going to make it. One night they came in and told me, said, we don't even know if he's going to make it through the night. And it was just me and him there that night. Mm-hmm. And I just kind of slept in the chair and was there with him when he woke up the next morning. And he woke up, he sat up in the bed, like he felt better, a lot better that morning. And he looked at me and said, Dad, when I get better, I want to go to church. I want you to take me because you need to go too. Mm-hmm. I mean, in that situation, and he said that, it went into my heart, you know. I was like, oh, okay. All right. And then I got back to work after he got a little better. It was probably a couple of weeks later. Eddie Miller, which is a member of the Owensboro Cumberland Presbyterian Church, asked me if I would come to a chicken dinner. I was having barbecue chicken at their church, I guess a Wednesday night or something.
Yeah, that's a hard thing to pass up.
All right, yeah. That's 500 pounds. You offer me some chicken, I'm coming. But yeah. But my son had just said that to me, and I was like, you know what? My son said he wanted to go to church. I'll be there. And I've never left. I started at that church, and I wasn't a Christian really yet. I seen it in other people, and I used to sit there in the pew and just pray to God and beg, be like, I want to have what they got. Mm. I want to believe. I see the faith that they have. I see the joy they find from it, but I don't have that. It's like I need to see it or something, you know. And I prayed that, you know, the whole time I would go there, and there'd be nights I'd be up all night drinking still, and I'd get up early on Sunday and go. I had a guy pull me to the side once and told me I smelled like alcohol, but I was trying still, you know. And somebody sent me on an Emmaus walk during that time. Mm. I don't know if you know what that is or anybody listening might, but I think that's a
just
thing.
Brief, for those who don't know, briefly describe the Emmaus walk.
Can't.
Yeah, you can't really say a whole lot about it. It's a 4-day thing you go to, and you go there just to experience God. Mm-hmm. You'd be with 30 other women or 30 other men when you go, and it's just a walk through the life of Christ, kind of like the walk to Emmaus. They were there with Jesus the whole time and didn't realize it. And I think that's what Emmaus walk is. You'll be there the whole time with Jesus, and generally you'll realize it by the time that the 4 days is up.
Tell me more about how that transformed, how that changed you. That part you can tell me about.
The big part I took away from it was changed my priorities in life. The way that I was working, and I wanted to spend more time trying to be a dad to my kids. And that was the big thing for me. And I knew I needed to slow down with the drinking. And I did. I told people at the Emmaus walk the first time, the first 4 days I went in a row without drinking in 30 years was at my Emmaus walk.
Wow.
Yeah.
That's an accomplishment.
Yeah. And, you know, I think really when it came down to me stopping is when I just started feeling bad from it. And I started slowing down, and then it was probably 6 months after I slowed down is when I was diagnosed. And I worked with a guy named Scott Brown at the counter at this electrical place that I worked at, and he had had a brain tumor pretty recently to that, probably a year before. And he'd come in all the time happy, and he'd do his job, and he was happy. And one day I just finally looked at him. I said, what is in your mind that you're going through what you're going through? And you seem like it ain't bothering you. He's like, Jesus has my back, brother. He said, I win no matter what with this. I either go see God or I get to stay back here a little longer. It's whatever he makes a choice of. He was a true Christian man, still is. But yeah, things like that, he was a big help as well, you know. But yeah, whenever I got sick, I looked to God and I was like, look, I've been trying this thing out. Here's the shot, you know, I need your help. Mm-hmm. And after that, you know, with all that in my mind that I had that only 4 months left to live, I'd pray myself to sleep some nights. Kept my Bible close and started reading it and really trying to find him. And, you know, so it was really my illness going through all of that that really locked it in for me.
Well, the timeline kind of helped as well. It's really weird how it all came together because, I mean, Cage was sick. Then you got invited to church. Then you did the Emmaus walk. This is when his health started deteriorating really worse and worse until he found out he had a problem. And at that point, he was going to the Owensboro Cumberland Presbyterian Church. And if it wasn't for some of the financial aid that that church was able to offer him and his family at that time, he wouldn't have been able to get to Mayo Clinic. You know, he wouldn't, his family wouldn't have been able to eat. He was having, you know, like his floors in his trailer house were falling apart.
Yeah, we had a water heater.
This was how bad he was at that point. And to see that with that timeline, how all of that right before he went to Mayo Clinic with God finally, you know, showing himself at those times is what was able to, I think, to get Danny through being at the hospital and being through all that. Because finally he saw it. He saw what he was. God was there for him.
The first thing I ever run into in my life I couldn't fix by myself.
That's pretty scary, isn't it?
Yeah, I was like, I need you now. I said, if you can get me the other side of this, I'll use the whole rest of my life doing whatever you lead me to. I won't say no to nothing. Mm. And I'm sitting here today.
So really, as you're kind of putting your life back together and examining your priorities and asking questions, you know, how does God kind of work in the world and in my life and in my family's life, is when your health starts deteriorating.
Yeah.
That's a prime opportunity for a relationship with God to really be strengthened or fall apart. It's kind of a fragile time.
It was, yeah. I think that was my chance. It's like either you go, you know what I mean? I had that, the Paul got struck by a lightning moment, you know?
All right. So after you go through multiple health scares for your son, and then of course for yourself, and you're on this side of it, you're regaining your strength and clearing up your head. How does that lead into kind of where you are today? Where does your calling and ministry, how does all that play in your journey?
Well, you know, they told me I might be brain damaged, so it took me a long time to get my head straight. And I think that's all my ex at the time was waiting for, is once she seen I was all right to get kick me out. So I actually lived in a guy's car for a little while here in Owensboro because I was paying all of their bills. And while I was in Minnesota, I had met one time I went up there just for some health stuff afterwards. And I got up Sunday morning and just Googled nearest church to Mayo Clinic and found one and got a cab and went and met these people. Well, while I was living in the car, I was texting them and they was like, you just need to get away for a while. You should come up here and you can stay with us and you can be close to Mayo and help get your health straight.
And folks from the church that you found are the
ones in Minnesota.
Okay.
So I moved up there and stayed in their basement until I got financially well enough to get me an apartment up there. And I was going back and forth to Mayo and to the gym, getting myself back to where I needed to be. And that's when I met Jessica.
He met me.
Yeah, this is where.
This is the weird part, because we both went to the church, Owensboro Church, and that had been my church for a long time. And when he was trying to get himself healthy again, he came into the church super skinny, couldn't barely keep his pants on. He had a belt that was so tight, like his pants were looped about a foot away from his waist. And I just remember sitting there, because I was in there, I always have my donuts and coffee in the morning with everybody, and he came in and Pastor shook his hand, and so I offered him a seat. This is before, you know, anything. And I just offered him a seat, and I was married at the time to my first husband, and I was actually pregnant with my daughter, and sat him down and was just chatting with him, you know, and enjoying his company. And I was like, well, hey, like nobody else said anything to him. It was just me. And I was like, you should come to my Sunday school, you know? So it was just a very random moment there that we both remember. And then I didn't see him again for, gosh, how long was it?
Probably.
It was probably a year. Yeah. And he had messaged me when he was up in Mayo, because like right after he talked to me at the church, he went to Mayo, or I mean to Minnesota. And so we had talked, and then like a year later, I get a message on Facebook. How are you doing? I'm healthy and up in Minnesota. What's going on? And I'm like.
And just to make the story clear there, her husband did the same thing to her that my wife did to me.
Yeah, he left me.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. And she, when we started talking, Adeline was 4 months old.
She was
Adeline is May, my daughter. June
6 or 7 months old. She just started crawling.
Yeah.
Yeah. So we were both divorced.
Yeah.
And
I was in Minnesota and she was in Kentucky.
Yeah. So make that clear, y'all. We were.
Yeah. Well, Danny, you're in Minnesota. What led you to send Jessica a Facebook message?
That was
Dr. Newton. Yeah.
Dr. Newton was a savior for me during my divorce. Him and his wife, Vicky, kind of took me under their wing and would help with my kids whenever they needed to. So I spent a lot of time talking to them and chatting. Well, I guess there was a picture he just liked of me, so he posted it on Facebook, on his Facebook.
Yeah.
And that's when Danny saw it and sent me a message.
Oh, okay. Hey, how you doing?
Yeah.
But yeah, we talked on the phone for 4 months or so, and then I flew back to Owensboro for a week, and we went out and everything for that week, and I went back to Minnesota, and it took me a couple months to gather my, you know, close up all my loose ends there, because I was working at a church there as an outreach minister. So.
Oh, okay. All right. So let's go back a little bit. You moved to Minnesota.
Yes.
You're living in a car, and I wanted to ask you.
I was living
you,
in the car before I went to Minnesota.
And living in the car before, but you continue to live in a car. And then the church that you found, they allowed you to live in their basement temporarily until you found an apartment.
Yeah, well, it was a man and woman.
Oh, okay. You lived in not the church basement,
their
but their
house.
Yeah, I
house.
Stayed at their house, and then I got me an apartment. But the church offered me a job cleaning the church.
Mm-hmm.
And I was doing that, but one day the pastor there, he's like, I gotta go do a couple visitations at the hospital, won't you come with me? And by the time he got back, he's like, I'm making you an outreach minister. It's like, I've never seen anybody be so outgoing and just walk up to anybody and start talking to them in my life. So he made me an outreach minister. So, and I was like, well, I wanted to get ordained, you know.
Mm-hmm.
And that was a non-denominational church.
Mm-hmm.
And he told me he put me under my wing and they would ordain me there, you know. So I thought I'd found my calling, you know.
Mm-hmm.
But when me and her did start talking, I did a lot of praying, you know, like, what do you want me to do? And then when I was on the visit, though, me and her attended the Owensboro Cumberland Presbyterian Church, and Terry Moss was teaching the Sunday school. And he told me, so I wish I had somebody to help me teach this Sunday school class. And I thought about that the whole time I'm back in Minnesota, you know, those 2 months I spent before I moved back. And when I moved back, I was like, let me help you do it. And that's kind of where I got my whole start toward the direction I'm at now. You know, I started teaching the Sunday school class, and it grew and grew to the point we were having bring in extra chairs and about to have to get a different room before I actually left and started pastoring church or filling pulpits.
All right.
That's crazy part, though, is in between all that is when you came back to the church and they all saw that I was dating him.
Oh, yeah. My own pastor pulled me to the side and threatened me. If you hurt that girl, she's like my daughter now.
I was kind of his loophole into the church, to be honest, because
all everybody knew me from was my past.
Yeah, from his past. They're like, what is she doing with him?
Yeah.
So, Jessica, as you guys are growing closer together, what do you guys text and talk about? How did that relationship kind of get nurtured and grow?
Gosh, that's been like 10 years ago.
Yeah, I think it was because we were completely honest with one another.
Because
we wasn't face to face.
We had just gone through divorces, and we were somebody we both could talk to. He was very broken, medically broken,
and mentally at that point somewhat.
And I guess I found him a little intriguing in that way too, with me being in the medical profession. I always tell everybody he's my like medical experiment.
Fell in love with her, honestly. I'll tell you, with the first conversation that we ever had, where we actually talked on the phone, and I told her, I said, they said that there's a chance that I might have to have a kidney transplant. At the time they thought I would. And she's like, I'll give you one. Can I give you one? And she meant it. She literally meant it. And I'm like, I want to marry this girl. To be that kind, you know?
Right.
Hey, we might need to stop for a second. My battery's low. I'm going to have to plug in, buddy.
Okay. All right. Do you need to,
need to go get a cable and plug this in.
All right. Absolutely. Go ahead. I'll
you
stay
said
here.
You could stop it if we had to.
Yeah.
We got to, the screen's going dimmer.
Okay.
Yeah, sorry. We're really back and forth on all of our stories. He's got such a big one. It's hard to keep the timeline in play.
Well, yeah, but it's kind of fun because I can ask, well, for my own benefit so that I can follow, but it slows Danny down a little bit too, so that he can, so yeah, because I want to live in that moment and be empathetic to it and to best understand Danny and you. And Danny, you're ready to jump to the next chapter. It's like, yeah, okay, that chapter's over. Now I want to go to this other chapter.
Yeah, I'm sorry.
In a good way. No,
I think he's just trying to make this kind of quick for you, because and there's no quickness to this.
I was trying to do is make it give you this. I've told this so many times. At one point, I said it so much that she's even like, you know, you're more than just that. And she was right.
He used to talk about his story for like the first 2 or 3 years we were together. And you know how hard it is for somebody to be like, you don't have to keep living through that all the time. Yeah. You're going to have a future. Sure. And you need to start living in the now, mm-hmm, rather than what happened to you way back when. Because that's literally all he would talk about forever. And, you know, I'm living with him. We're married. I hear the story all the time. And I'm like, you have got to get some new stories. I'm like, but on top of it, I was not there through his sickness.
Right.
You know, so I was an outsider at that point. I was at the church praying for him while he was in the hospital, because we went to the same church he had just started going. I tell him all the time that the first time I ever saw him was he was in front of the doors. I think he was putting on Cage's coat or holding Cage's coat to come, his son Cage, to come to leave. And he was like big old boy, you know, this big old guy. With nothing but black on, everything was saggy and baggy. Yeah. I didn't really talk to him a whole lot then. But that's what I remember him like. And then I remember his kid Cage, who I would literally turn around and go into a different room because he was so loud and boisterous and too much for me. And I was like, oh my gosh, that kid, I love him to death, but man, he's got it, he had Jesus in him.
So Jessica, what was your reaction of that relatively brief time gap of seeing Danny as he was going through health issues and alcoholism and all kinds of stuff, and then fast forward to when he shows up in Owensboro again, and here he's wearing a belt that's 8 sizes too large.
This is the funny part. Okay, so the whole time I was sitting there, I was like, man, I wish I could just take him and go shopping with him. I want to be able to buy him a wardrobe. He deserves this. Who would have guessed down the road I bought his whole life? He literally came to me with one of those duffel bags, one duffel bag. That's all he had. He had nothing else.
Yeah.
Never took anything from his other wife. Mm-hmm. He let them just have it. Mm-hmm. He was giving. He didn't care. He was, you know, that was fine. And then that's where he came to me. And
with a duffel bag and dreams of ministry.
Which is where everybody was like, Jessica, what are you doing?
Yeah.
What are you doing? I always told him it was because I could see more in him than what his outer appearance was. And I've always said I think I've been a pretty good people reader for most of my life. And you know, I could see the softness and the soul he had. And a lot of people couldn't see that.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So while he was with me in the last how many years? I mean, we've met.
9 now.
I mean, the church loves him. Everybody loves him. So, you know.
There's a big change from who I used to be.
A little connection was it's definitely a God thing too. And it happened at a really good time for both of us. Because not only could I help him, he could help me. I mean, I was going through a lot too. I mean, this was a lot, but.
Yeah, with me not being, at that point, I couldn't work. I couldn't even carry a 12-pack of bottled water, you know. So she's like, you just help with Adeline. And I got to work all the time. So until you get better, that's it. So I that's when I said, you know, I'm going to go to seminary or whatever, but I'm going to wait until Adeline starts school so she don't ever have to go to daycare. So I did that.
I got my very own house husband.
Yeah, I was a house husband. And I got to take care of that baby. That's why I said Adeline's just like my baby. I love her. She couldn't be any closer to a God-given child. And she is a God-given child. Let me take that back.
All right, so you're at the Owensboro Church and teaching a Sunday school class, and you were saying earlier that it was growing. Talk more about the transition from being a Sunday school teacher into pursuing the vocation of minister.
It was actually really hard.
Yeah,
I talked to him. Because Pastor Tim like wasn't too sure about it.
Yeah, and I get it now looking back, but yeah.
How he was. Look, he gave me a face.
And I came back quick.
He was just like, are you, I don't know.
It was
know.
A big
are you
change
sure
real
you
quick.
Want to do this?
Like, yeah.
He just wasn't real sure about it. But after that, after he had been in that Sunday school room for so long, we kind of taught it kind of together.
Yeah.
I was kind of his side wing. I read all of the stuff.
Yeah.
And I think after he saw that that was growing and how we were able to grow a lot of the young couples there, that's when, you know, you went back. I mean,
yeah, I was like, I want to be a, I just
he
asked him.
He talked to our pastor all the time, you know, and finally, I think he was like, I think you're ready.
Yeah, I was just like, maybe I could just be the assistant pastor here. That's all I wanted. Mm-hmm. You know, I seen that maybe I did have a gift for ministry, you know, and he said, well, you got to go to school. And that took me probably a year before I was like, all right, I'll go to school, you know. And
he didn't want to do that at all.
I did not do good in school.
Y'all, he is so against college education.
Yeah, I did not want to
like,
go.
No joke. He was like, that just gives people a big head. And I'm like, really? So is that what you're telling me? I am. I have
But, you know, I went to the community college here and signed up for classes. And I was like, I don't know if this is going to work or not. You know, I got anxiety and ADHD and everything, but I think that is what made it work for me because I was so afraid of failing that I poured everything into it. And I made the dean's list my very first semester at 47 years old, 46 years old.
It was another blessing that he didn't know he even had when he was in high school. He had taken so many classes for college. He was almost done.
Yeah. Didn't even know it.
He didn't even know it. So he just needed like it was another year of.
No, I think I had a year and a half, 2 years of community college to get my. To
yeah,
get
but
my
he had a
associates.
Whole bunch of credits that he didn't even realize, and then by the end of his 2 years, he even made another loophole because they thought he was going to have to take another class. Remember that? There was a they changed some. They changed something in their what do you call it?
Curriculum
to where one of his classes ended up counting.
Oh,
so
yeah, that's
done.
Right. Yeah.
All of a sudden, he was just done.
I went to go take classes and get books and stuff. And they were like, you're not enrolled. And I'm like, I already enrolled. I got two classes to take. And by the end of that day, they was like, oh, you have two other credits. You're done. So that was great.
Wow.
When I started the BOSS program immediately.
Well, before we get into the program of alternate studies, Danny, has your perspective on education softened any?
Oh yeah. A lot of, if anything, I think you could go to college and take something you don't even care about, and you'd learn. You'd be more organized and more goal oriented. Mm-hmm. I've always been kind of I want to get it done now, or I'm not going to do it. Mm-hmm. You know, even the big jobs I take on a car, I walk out there and I'm like, I'll work all day until I'm falling apart without even eating to get something done then. So, yeah, taking long-term goals, that was hard for me to accept, but I think it helped open that up in my mind now, you know?
Yeah, like way more in being supportive of when the kids, I mean, we got two older boys and one of them's about to go and graduate this year and he's getting ready to do automotive. And
yeah, he's going to go get a degree in automotive
technology.
This guy's
pretty excited about it.
Yeah.
He is just so stoked that, you know, we'll have a kid in college, so.
All right, Danny, you got a taste of ministry in Minnesota and then back in Owensboro at the Owensboro Cumberland Presbyterian Church through Sunday school and your calling, and you revisited your calling. And then you revisited one more year because you weren't real sure about going back to school.
Yeah.
And then I interrupted you. You were about to talk about the program of alternate studies. Okay, now you can run with the program of alternate studies.
I love Michael Qualls, by the way. I'll shout out to him. But he was the main guy over the past. I think now he's vice president of the whole seminary or something. He stepped up somewhere. But
he's a man of many talents. He's a man of many talents, many jobs.
Yeah, and when I first started the POS program, I was like, how many classes can you take at a time? And he's like, well, we had somebody take 9 once, but he failed. I was like, but I can take 9. And they were like, yeah, if you want to try it. So I took 9 classes at a time all the way through. I think I set a record getting through POS. But all right. And I was successful. I think I was all straight A's, but maybe 3 B's or something all the way through. So mm-hmm. I was able to take big chunks out of it because – again, I don't like to wait for results, so I took it as quick as I could.
So what's next, Danny,
in
terms of ministry and life?
You've caught me at a very vulnerable time, actually. Mm-hmm. This past, I stayed at Mount Olivet for the past, be almost 5 years in October. Mm-hmm. You know, when I started to go fill pulpits, I went to that church and I fell in love with them. And you know, me being disabled, I can only make a very small amount of money. So, you know, I thought that part of my calling is I can go help churches that can't pay a whole lot for a pastor. Mm-hmm. And I went to Mount Olivet and fell in love with them. And again, I stayed there almost 5 years now, but Easter was my last Sunday there. We got to do a baptism and everything. And we had the whole Holy Week celebration. It was hard to leave. I mean, I really do love those guys with all of my heart. You know, I spent time with them and their families and grown to know all of them. And it's hard to leave. It really is. I even had second thoughts about it because it's hard to leave people. But I keep telling myself in the back of my head, that's going to be part of ministry, you know. And I know it's time. God was telling me deep in my heart and her too that there's something else for me, and I don't know what it is. So yeah, you caught me at a vulnerable time with that. I'm fixing to jump in my car and drive cross country by myself. I need to get away sometimes, but to do some prayer and camping and go see some stuff.
Share more of what it's like to be in this stage of your life and your stage of your faith and your ministry, because you're in a season of change and yet the near future is unknown. Well, it's always mm-hmm. unknown, but in terms of your vocation, your calling, and what that may look like, it's typically when we're in ministry or really any vocation, when you step away from the vocation, you have something else lined up.
Yeah,
but
I don't.
But in this case, you don't. So
no, I'm waiting. I'm trying to discern what God wants for me. I tell people all the time, one of my pieces of advice is a goldfish will never find the ocean unless he jumps out the boat.
Okay.
So that's what I've done. You know, I kind of take my own advice. If I say it, if you preach it, you got to live it, you know. So
right.
I've been working as a chaplain at the hospital my wife works at. Mm. I do enjoy that. But again, you know, when God tells you got to go, you got to go. And I don't know what it is yet. And I don't want to say the wrong way, but I've been disappointed that, you know, churches are just getting empty nowadays. There's got to be another way, you know. And I know there's been a lot of people try to figure it out. Like, what do we do now? And that's where I'm at. What do we do now? Yeah. Again, you know, the church is inside the four walls and it needs to go out and start being church again. Mm. And I think a lot of that is churches that become protective. We almost have to be nowadays, you know. I think the most rebellious thing you can do in life now is be a Christian. So I think we've become inwardly focused because of that. We've gone into protect mode, and we can't minister like that, you know.
Yeah, it's difficult to minister when you're in survival mode, protection mode,
yeah.
And we often are resistant to change, and we can become very defensive. It's hard to share the gospel when you're distracted and when you're defensive.
Yeah.
And when we get too worried about the rules and regulations, how much different are we from the Pharisees? You know what I mean? Jesus hung out with sinners. So yeah, I don't know what the next step is for me. I don't know what it looks like.
Well, besides feeling vulnerable, what other emotions would you attach to that list?
Anxious. Well, yeah, I'm very anxious. You know, I don't. Yeah, not being attached by the paycheck, and that maybe that's something to do with it. You know, God wants me to do something. Maybe another way of reaching people. Like I said, I still want to probably wind up pastoring the church, but I got to make sure that whatever He wants me to do lines up with that. You know, because I do enjoy it. It's very hard to walk away from being a pastor. I enjoy it. I love, you know, like I've said before, I've always loved helping people. It's just a continuation of that. I just like to help people with the problems, you know, and God's the way, the only way to really fix a problem.
But even feeling vulnerable and anxious, there's a stronger call to step away from what is familiar, what you have known for the past 5 years. Talk more about that. Talk about what that it is, that thing that is driving you to step away from the comfortable. If you can, maybe we'll have to swing back around and revisit. Maybe there isn't language.
Well, no, I think, like, well, you're not going to catch a deer if you don't go deer hunting. You know what I mean? Mm-hmm. If you just stay in one place, maybe you're not going to find what it is, and I don't know what it is. You know, and I probably go pull some pulpits and stuff like that. Maybe that's what I wound up doing. I have no idea. You know, I, for the longest time, I thought I knew what my calling was, and it's not. So what is it, you know?
That must be freeing at the same time, to be able to step into the unknown.
But you know what God did for me in my illness maybe makes me a little more brave than the average. You know, if He had my back through that, then I ain't worried about stepping away from the church for a little bit until I find where He needs me to go next. You know?
Maybe you have literally faced death on more than one occasion. So what may be fearful or anxious driven for some, maybe it doesn't register with you in the same way.
Yeah.
It doesn't.
My anxiety is
not. It doesn't. This is where that all goes on me.
Yeah, she's the one.
This is where we make a great team, because he doesn't think about all that stuff. And thankfully, we've been blessed to have a structure in our life. Mm-hmm. I'm kind of the structure.
Yeah. Oh, definitely. She keeps
that
order,
allows man. Him to still be able to do the things he gets to do, and which is great, because that's where he needs to be. He needs to be able to have that. What's the word?
Freedom.
I guess freedom. Yeah the freedom to try new things, and he's not scared to try. So.
Yeah, there's something wrong in any of our relationships if we are not urged to seek and discover, to be creative, to dream. That can be stifling for the development of the relationship with God or a spouse or a loved one, a child, whoever that may be.
Yeah. Yeah, she's been a big part of me. I mean, I'd have never gotten here without her. She definitely keeps me in order. I'm not good with structure. Like, I'm going on this trip and next week maybe, and I've not made any plans. I fly by the shirt. So, I mean, she's the one that kind of, she grounds me, and I love her.
Well, Danny, you have experienced and seen a lot of things. What advice do you have for somebody who may be facing a tremendous health scare that is going to change the way that they currently live, or maybe a loved one? What helped you walk through those life and death experiences, and what advice do you have?
Mine was just faith, strong faith. I just knew he wasn't going to let me die. You know, I don't know if that was part of my calling at the time, that if he was getting me through that, I would do what I'm doing now or whatever. But yeah, I just had faith that I wasn't going to die. Like I said, the only person that didn't believe it was my son, or that did believe me was my son. So it was a bad circumstance to be in, and he pulled me through it. So, I mean, but I believed he would. Mm-hmm. Truly believed that he would, and he did. And I don't like to give that advice. I stumbled on that just a bit, because I did believe there are some things, the people that have faith and still, you know, succumb to what illness they have.
Sure, absolutely. But I was wondering what helped you through.
Yeah, it was faith. and my kids. I knew the life they would have if I didn't make it.
Let's talk about the Cumberland Presbyterian Church that the three of us are a part of.
Yes.
And in this time of transition, what is your hope for the church now and in the future? You alluded earlier about looking and living outside of the walls of the church, but put some meat to that. What could that look like? What does that mean?
More outreach. I think we definitely need to outreach more. Mm-hmm. I mean, you look, we got a couple churches here in town that are just growing and growing and growing. I met the pastor recently at an Emmaus walk, and I have tattoos, but this man had full sleeve tattoos. All of them are religious and stuff. Didn't look like he'd be a pastor at all, but this is his church, you know, and they got, they're connected to one of the drug and alcohol places here. Mm. And that's the way I found my faith. You know, that's who I was. And then it was the only thing strong enough, the only thing that ever made me want to change that was Jesus. And I know in my heart, I would not have changed if it wasn't from Jesus. And I think that stands true with a lot of those people. So, I mean, when you're going out and you're getting people that are broken and you fix their life and they come to Jesus, well, you're going to have a hopping church. They praise Jesus in that church and they're busting out at the seams. You know, I've seen the pictures of the men's breakfast and it's overflowing, and it's because of outreach. They're going out and finding sinners, and when they find Jesus, they're loyal to where they found it. So yeah, they're just looking for Jesus. It doesn't matter what the rules and regulations and you know what I mean? And I think sometimes, again, as we went into defense mode, that we forget who we was maybe at one time. You know, I know there's people that's been Christian your whole life. She has. Mm-hmm. You know, maybe they don't know what it's like to not have Christ. But when you haven't had and you find him, man, you're on fire. I love, that's my best thing to see is when somebody finds Jesus.
Mm. It can be contagious, for sure.
Oh, my gosh. That's why I still go back. And this last Emmaus walk was my first time on the minister team. And there was a guy there that I knew well, and he bawled throughout the whole thing, and me and him's had breakfast since. And it's just amazing to see somebody find Jesus and change their whole life. You know, that's all I want to do. I mean, you can't do that in four walls. So the church has to we got to get better at outreach or somehow. And I don't know what it looks like. You know, I know everybody's looking for outreach that works, but you got to outreach to broken people.
Jessica, you've been a longtime member at Owensboro Church. What are your hopes for the church now and in the future?
Well, yeah, it's been my home for 15 years. Been going for longer than most of them, actually. Which is kind of weird because I feel like I'm not that old yet. I've always... I mean, I helped with the youth and I got to see the youth grow, but it seems like when the youth grows, they leave. So they've got to figure out a way to keep their babies in that church is really what I see. And I don't want to see, I don't like seeing the churches fall apart. And it kind of feels like anymore, it's a hard way to keep them together, everybody, because everybody has their own opinions. And it takes a really strong person to try to keep all those opinions together. And I mean, who is it going to be? I don't know. I tell my husband all the time, that church was my family. Mm-hmm. I fought for that church. I went through my divorce with that church. I went through my new marriage with that church. My son was 2 when we started going to that church, and now he's 17. So it's just,
a lot of the people we love are gone now.
Yeah. And like my pastor will always be my pastor. And that was Pastor Tim, and he's not there anymore.
Tim McGuire.
So, and I hate to be like, well, that he made it home for me, but he kind of did. So it's been really hard here lately for me, actually, with the change of things going on in that church. Because I've always had that, I call it my childlike faith, because I still see religion through the eyes of how I did when I was in Sunday school, you know. I don't need to question my religion. I don't need to know all these answers to these questions. I just believe. Mm-hmm. And that's always how I've been. I think Danny says that's one of my, what do you call it? That's my, every person has
a gift.
He says that's my gift, is that I just always believe. I've just always believed. I've never not. And he'll start asking me questions about different things. And I'm like, you got to talk about Jonah and the whale or something, okay? I'm over here still remembering all of my little, you know, childlike. That's why I love teaching Sunday school to the kids, because that's where I'm at. And I don't want to grow. I'm sorry.
I don't want to learn
any of these horrible things. I want to still be happy and sunshine, flowers, and kisses, okay? And that's what made her so useful
to me.
I'm just faithful. Mm-hmm. I'm faithful, and that's all I need. I don't need people to question or give me answers to my questions. You're not going to give me the answer. It's up there, and I'll find it one day. So
the two of you balance, you know, in terms of grappling with theological questions to simple faith and blending.
Yeah, well, I'm the simple one.
Well, I tell other people I don't consider myself to be a theologian. I don't, and that's why I asked her these questions. I think that makes me a better pastor in a way, mm-hmm. or a better preacher, is because I don't want to say things that people don't understand. And when she's talking about me asking her these questions, I just want to find out what the average Christian knows.
Mm. Okay.
And then he can bounce it off of me, because he's like, oh, you don't know that? Well, we're going to learn about that today.
Okay, I get it. See, the two of you really do complement each other. So while you're doing your sermon preparation or Sunday school class, devotion, whatever it may be, you share with Jessica some elements to see, is there a different way to articulate the same concept or phrase or thought or definition?
Yes.
That's wonderful. The two of you have it.
So to speak.
Yeah.
Yeah. If I say something and she looks at me crooked, I'm like, well, I can't use that in a sermon. You know,
are you going to have to explain?
I got to do it different. Yeah. So the biggest compliment I can ever get is when people tell me, I understand what you say. I understand your service. I listen to you because I understand. Nice. You make sense to me. That, to me, that is the, not that I use big words, not because I know how to speak Greek or Hebrew. It's because I can express the word of God in a way that you understand it.
Well, and then you all have to remember that he didn't grow up in the church. So sometimes he'll say something to me and I'll spring up one of those songs that we used to know, you know?
And I don't know the songs. Yeah, so I've stuck stuff in my sermon about y'all have heard the old song, and I didn't know it.
He is a man, and he's like, you do know that story.
Yeah. I told that on her one day. I said, do you know about the guy climbing the pole to see Jesus? And she said, I started singing a song, and I was like, oh, okay.
Okay, my next question is for the two of you. We'll start with Danny. Danny, where do you go to get rejuvenated, renewed, filled with encouragement that helps your faith?
Well, I like working Emmaus walks. I like doing stuff outside of your church and get into some interdenominational things. You can always learn. You don't have to change your whole value to learn from somebody. But I know this might strike you as weird. I think it does some people, but my worship, you know, when you're a pastor and you plan for it all week, church and worship is a little different for you than you normal, you know. To me, I got to find a way of worship outside the church, and I love music. Love music, you know, and I get a lot of my worship through music, and I got a stereo I built in my car that sounds like a concert. And I'll tell anybody, you come over and sit in this car and let me play the right song and you'll cry. So yeah, I get in there and drive around. Some days I don't have anything to do, and I get in my car and just drive around listening to really loud Christian music.
You yeah, know? I cry too when I get in that car.
Different reason. But I've always been into car audio stuff, and music is such a way to worship for me. I just put the two together. Mm-hmm. And I worship in my car a lot, man. I read my scriptures every day. I love the Upper Room. I read that every day. Mm-hmm. I try to watch, you know, Christian programming when I can. But yeah, I think I get a lot of my worship from music.
Okay. Jessica, how about you?
Me?
Yeah.
Honestly, and it might be weird, probably is. I seem to be a very outspoken person and talk to everybody and super bubbly and happy, and I am. I wasn't always that way, which I think is why where I get my rejuvenating from is when I'm by myself at the house. Nobody's here. Like, seriously, I'm like, oh, honey, you wanted to go to Bowling Green and spend 2 days there with Lyle and work in the office? Go right ahead. I'm not even far. But yeah, so I get my.
So you don't get as much alone time.
Just being by myself and.
Got it.
Quiet.
Well, Danny, Jessica, thank you for giving me a big hunk of your day for us to talk.
I appreciate the opportunity to share with you.
Thank you for listening to this faith journey with Danny Willis. Share Cumberland Road with your family and friends so they too can hear about God's presence in people's lives. In closing, here are some words of Henry Nouwen from his book, In the Name of Jesus. The task of future Christian leaders is not to make a little contribution to the solution of the pains and tribulations of their time, but to identify and announce the ways in which Jesus is leading God's people out of slavery through the desert to a new land of freedom. Christian leaders have the arduous task of responding to personal struggles, family conflicts, national calamities, and international tensions with an articulate faith in God's real presence. Thanks for listening.